Blog Talk Radio.
This is the UR Tennis Network. We are the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate tennis enthusiasts who promote our sport relentlessly. We strive continuously to bring news and information for players, parents, coaches, officials, businesses, and anyone else who loves tennis. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis may not be interested in them.
Are we on?
Yep, we're on.
Let's go.
Broadcasting live from the Tennis Dynamic Studio in downtown Marietta, Georgia, this is the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the UR Tennis Network. Your host for the show this week is J.P. Weber.
Everybody, welcome back to another edition of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. If you are going to call in today, the call-in number is 714-583-6853. You can call into this number and participate with our guest today, or if you just want to listen to the show, you can call in as well and listen in that manner. If you want to, at some point later on, download the show to your iTunes capable, whatever you call them, radios, computers, anything else, and get the podcast, you can do that by going to your iTunes and plugging in either the UR Tennis Network or We Coach Tennis, and you should be able to get to that today. Our weather here in Atlanta is amazing, 61 degrees right now. The Dirty Birds are fighting the 49ers. They're trying to win for the first time in, I think, 2007, something like that. That they were, no, 2005 maybe. So we are here, and there's not many people out here at the courts today, but we've got a great guest this evening, Coach Paul Asciante. He is the head tennis and squash coach at Trinity College. It's a Division III school. From what I understand, he's very outgoing gentlemen, and he's been able to achieve a lot. He's achieved more than anybody else in collegiate sports. He has 244 consecutive dual match wins in squash, and they've gone undefeated. No other team, no other sport in collegiate history has achieved that record. And he's also the author of a couple of books. He wrote one book sometime back with Vic Braden, and then I think also he's also written a new book that's coming out, and I want to ask him some more about it. Rumor has it that Tom Hanks is going to play him, and it's a Run to the War is the name of the book, and we look forward to speaking to him. We will have Coach Asciante on in just a few minutes right after our first commercial break. So when we get back, we'll have him on, so stay with us.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, we're back, and hopefully I've got Coach Sassianti on the line. Coach Sassianti, is that you?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay, I was worried there a second. We were at commercial break, and I was watching. You were online with me, and then you disappeared, and you were back. And I have in the studio with me Tabani Satoli. He works. He sort of makes sure everything happens from a technical standpoint easy. And I was worried I was going to have to track you down without him. But you're back on, and so I'm grateful to have you. I don't know if you heard my intro. I explained to everybody that you're the a little bit of history here. You were at West Point. You were the tennis coach at West Point, and also the squash coach there. And then after you left there, what happened? You went on up into Rye, New York, and did some work up there as a pro and things.
I actually was. It's a funny thing. Ron Holmberg was the tennis coach at West Point, and Ron Holmberg is just a legendary figure, you know, one of the greats of all time, Tulane. And so Ron actually beat Rod Laver in the Wimbledon Junior Finals, and then Ron went off to Tulane and played Rod in the actual main draw of Wimbledon the next year. And Rod spanked him and said that Ron Holmberg was a product of the U.S. college system. So that was always an interesting idea. But anyway, so Ron was the tennis and squash coach there. And when he quit, I applied for the job. And they basically offered the job to 7 people, none of whom wanted the job. So they gave it to me by default. They took me downstairs and they said, this is a squash court, and now you're the head squash coach. And I'd never seen a court before. And the interesting part of that story is my mentor, the first phone call I made was to Bobby Bayless in Notre Dame, which, at that time he was at the Naval Academy. So you can imagine the Army coach calling the Navy coach to ask for help. But Bobby was just, was and still is, the great guiding light for me. I then went on and worked in the private country club world and played some professionally, and then was at Williams College for a bit and went back into the club world. And then I was lucky enough 20 years ago to land the job at Trinity College, which is a Division III school. We play a Division III tennis schedule, but we play a Division I squash schedule. So we play against all the top squash schools in the country.
Did you do me a favor? Tell me a little bit. Back up just a second. For our listeners, can you tell me how sort of important that rivalry between the Naval Academy and the in Army is? I mean, I know when I worked for Coach Bayless, he told me that it either made you or broke you kind of in a way as your career wise. The athletic director of the Naval Academy wouldn't care how he did against anybody else except Army.
No. I mean, Army-Navy was, the rumors and the hype you hear about Army-Navy is every bit as crazy as it's rumored to be. The intensity, I mean, there's a level of respect, obviously, between the two institutions, but it changes everything. In my 11 years at Army, I never beat Navy. And when I left, the Naval Academy gave me a beautiful plaque wishing me well, which I think it was really just a sign that they were hoping that I would stay at Army and continue my pretty sorry record. And Bayless was just a master of understatement. He's such a brilliant coach. And, we'd go down there and he'd say, wow, we hope we can keep it competitive and we hope it's a good match. In the meantime, fire is coming out of his eyes. And those kids from the Naval Academy were just superb players. And, it's the Army-Navy rivalry is crazy. When a match is beginning, they will have the entire corps of cadets or the midshipmen arrive to the match. so they stagger the contests for the day. So you can imagine starting off a tennis match, a college tennis match, in front of 4,400 midshipmen.
Oh, my goodness.
It is unbelievable. I used to have a recurring nightmare that, because I really didn't deserve the Army job. I really got it by default. And I would have this recurring nightmare that in the middle of an Army-Navy match, there would be a moment of quiet, and some general would stand up and scream, "Stop the match, this man is an imposter," and they would take me off in handcuffs. And it was really kind of a sobering dream, to say the least.
Well, as soon as we're on here right now, we've got a caller. Let's see if I've got a caller here. Caller, are you there? The 574 number?
Yes, I am. How you doing, brother?
Baby. How are you? It's Bullet. This is really, I couldn't ask for a better. This is just like the biggest treat of the day.
Well, it's the first caller, and then you guys were just telling me. Tell me, both of you, Bobby or Coach Bales, when you and I talked a little bit about the rivalry between the two schools and whatnot, back then, you guys were also at those schools recruiting some pretty incredible players, both of you, right?
Yeah, both of us had our share of good players, and the thing that helped me get a little edge on Paul was that I was there before he was, and there are only so many good athletes, good tennis players out there that would want to go to one of the three service academies, and I felt like to be competitive with the better schools, we almost had to get all of those guys. And if you could establish that kind of roster, then the other kids who are looking at the other two service academies, you'd have an edge in recruiting them. And so I was fortunate that when Ron left West Point, they took a long time naming a coach, and they lost a year in recruiting. And that was able to get me kind of on the board in that area, and we were able to stay there. But had I stayed at Navy, it was getting closer and closer all the time, and particularly in squash, Paul remembers the match where they had a bunch of match points on us, and he had one player just not play very well under pressure and sort of fall apart, and we were able to sort of sneak that one away.
Well, that was actually quite a match, because we were up in that match, and it looked like we were finally going to beat the Naval Academy and Bobby Bayless. And Bobby had been just such an amazing mentor and friend to me. So the match, we were up 4-3 maybe, and actually it wasn't even as close as the score sounds. And Bobby walked up to me and shook my hand, and he said, "Well, you certainly deserve this, and congratulations," and he left. And I guess he went down to the bus, and about 20 minutes later, he comes running back into the squash center. "What's going on here?" So I think that was actually Bobby's best coaching job, because he wasn't even in the facility when they came back and won the match.
Oh, man. Well, now, the rest of the country doesn't realize this, but up in the Northeast or in these areas, you guys had dual duties. You were squash coaches and tennis coaches, so you guys faced each other for a tennis season, but also faced each other during the squash season. And that is the way it works up there, right?
It doesn't any longer. The tennis has become such a big deal that I'm probably the last dinosaur still coaching both, and I'm sure the college is trying to figure a way to get rid of me. But Bobby was, again, as understated as he always was and is. But I got to be a fairly decent squash player. I actually won the World Doubles Championships in 1984. But the last time Bobby and I played, he beat me, and
I've never been put through a workout. I mean, and it's I'm not a squash player, so I would go there. And I thought that, I figured, well, maybe I could handle Coach Bayless. He's getting up there in the years. I could run balls down. It was it was the most humiliating thing to play him, because he would stand in the middle of the court there, and just, he humiliated me. It was the most. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but not only that, but he, you know, he made you feel badly about yourself while he was doing it, didn't he? And actually, it's a perfect
thing
to talk about.
I was big enough, neither one of you guys could get around me on. But
I will tell you another Baylor story, which is true, is and it seems appropriate on this given day. The Patriots are about to kick off against the Ravens, and so. Last year, Bill Belichick called me up and asked me if I would speak to the Patriots before one of their games, which to me seemed like, you know, my God, I've died and gone to heaven. And I got up there, and actually on the way up, I called Bobby and I said, well, you know, I've outdone you this time, buddy. I'm going to talk to the Patriots. And he says, oh, well, that's good. Tell Bill hello, because he used to play squash with me all the time when we were at the Naval Academy. So the first thing I said to Belichick was, you know, this is supposed to be my day in the sun. I said, so I understand you played a little bit of squash with Ballas. He said, yep, that guy used to beat me all the time. So, so I'm not the only one to lose to the guy.
Yeah, Paul, I don't think he would have given you much of a match.
Well, I will tell him that the next time I see him.
Well, JP, be sure to ask Paul about his consecutive win streak, which is the greatest in sports history.
I was heading that way. I'm wanting to find out. I'm wanting to get to the point to where I understand. I understand that Tom Hanks. There's going to be a movie out. Is this correct, Coach Chesty?
Yeah, it looks like the contract is going to be signed this week, and that my book Run to the Roar. I'm hearing an echo. Are you guys hearing an echo?
Yeah, I am too, but I'm not on a cell phone. I don't know. Are you, Paul?
Yeah, I'm on a cell phone.
I might try in between the comments. I might try to. I'll work on it here as well.
Okay. So at any rate, we wrote a book called Run to the Roar, which essentially. I wrote as an apology to my children. I was so busy trying to win championships and get highway signs and all of this stuff. And I accomplished all of that, but I wasn't there for my children when they needed me. So we wrote this book, and it was had three concepts to it. The first one was how to deal with fear, how to manage fear. The second one was learning life lessons through sport. And the third lesson was, you know, basically be there for your children. And the book did fairly well, and I've gotten a fair amount of public speaking opportunities out of it. I've spoken to, you know, big companies like Travelers and Aetna and, you know, Pfizer. So the group came up to us and said, we want to make this into a movie. Are we still echoing out there?
No, everything's good.
Oh, great. So anyway, this group came up and said, we want to make this into a movie. And there's a fellow that lives in Greenwich who wrote all the Die Hard movies. And he said he wanted to write this screenplay for this movie, which, as you can imagine, I'm just a tennis and squash coach. So I can't get my brain around this concept at all. But at any rate, you know, my first question was, well, who's going to be me in the movie? My wife is pretty convinced it was going to be Pee Wee Herman. But it doesn't appear that it's going in that direction. And they're talking to a bunch of A-list movie people right now.
Well, Coach Bayless, would you cast would it be Tom Hanks, or would it be Bruce Willis, or would it be Harrison Ford, or what would you cast him, you think? Are you there, Coach Bayless?
Oh, yeah, you're asking me.
Yeah, I was asking you. I
like Harrison Ford for that.
That would be a good Coach Asciante, Harrison Ford, okay?
Right.
Who are they thinking about, Coach Asciante?
Well, I had heard something about Tom Hanks. I don't know. I mean, I can't get my brain around it at all. But, you know.
Well, he's played a coach before. He's played a coach before in the movie about women's baseball.
Yeah, well, I think based on my Army-Navy record, I should probably have Donna Reed be my uh, you could be me in the movie.
Well, so tell us about the book, the premise of the book, and how it came to be.
We were going to write a squash book, and, you know, first of all, five people play squash. So if you join the Squash Association, you immediately get a world ranking. So we knew that if we wrote a book, a how-to book on squash, you know, that was going to sell like two copies. So this book morphed into really a sort of a self-story, if you will. It became an autobiography. And basically, what I wanted to get across is, I think, one of the things that holds people back in every aspect of their lives is an inability to manage fear. And you know, really, what you fear owns you. And that was one of the primary, you know, concepts in the book. And, you know, when you refer or you look back to the most successful people in history, they seem to be able to manage or minimize that fear. For instance, probably the greatest fighters in history were the samurai. And the samurai were so successful because they had already come to grips with what was the very worst thing that could happen on the battlefield, which was death. They were not afraid to die. And once you reach that level, you can't be beaten. And so where the title Run to the Roar comes from, and this is a true story, is that when lions hunt, they hunt in packs. And they take with them the oldest female of the tribe. And by this point, she's infirm, she's blind, she doesn't have many teeth. You know, she can't catch her own prey anymore. She looks a little bit like Bayless and I. And they bring her out into the middle of the bush because she has the deepest roar. And when this female lion roars, the prey run away from the roar to their death. But if they went at the roar, they would find out that it's just a toothless old lady. And so that's one of the things I talk about all the time. Go at the problem. Go at what you perceive to be the challenge. Because if you do, it's invariably never as bad as you think it's going to be. And so that was what we started this book out with. It was ironic because I got a phone call from the president of Penguin Books, and he said, well, you have a little problem. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, your title has been used before. And I said, oh, my God, what does that mean? And he said, well, the good news is you can't copyright a title, so you can still have your title. And I said, well, just out of interest sake, who used my title before? And he said, well, it's Tammy Faye Baker. So normally when I speak, I wear a lot of lipstick and rouge and eye makeup, and it goes pretty well.
Now, so I'm assuming that from what I began reading it was a late edition that I was able to even to arrange you to get on the show. But it talks of the focus of the book is that it's a match between Trinity and Princeton at the national championships, and it goes on. It talks about your way of, will the movie be on that? Will the screenplay be the same sort of thing? Will it look at your career?
Yeah.
Go on.
Well. Yeah, there's a beautiful plaque at West Point, and it's a quote from MacArthur, and the quote is that on the friendly fields of strife are sown the seeds that on later fields will bear the fruits of victory. And what I took that to mean is that you learn more about yourself on the athletic field than you do in almost any other forum. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to have a vehicle that would be the skeleton of the book, that lessons of over 40 years could be shared. So the vehicle was the squash national finals at Princeton 3 years ago, where we came back and won a match after being down, you know, a ton of match points. So there are 9 matches in a college match, and each boy that played a match is one of the chapters of the book. But that boy sort of represents a concept, if you will. So for one of the boys, it was ownership. He had a hard time developing ownership over his own journey. And so that chapter then leads us into being able to talk about all the different elements of ownership that we see in sport. And so it was a very complicated book to write. It took 8 years. And Jim Zug, the author of the book, and I co-wrote it, and it was, he just did a masterful job pulling it all together.
Now, the foreword by Tom Wolfe, is that the same Tom Wolfe?
Yeah, the foreword is by Tom Wolfe. His son played for me, and Tom is, you know, Tom grew up in the town that Bobby Bayless played for. He grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and
yeah,
he was a Spider, although Tom went to Washington and Lee. And so he wrote the foreword for the book, and that was just mind-blowing to, you know. And actually, to be honest with you, Tom's fingerprints are all over this project because, you know, I'm Paul Asiente. I'm not important. Nobody really knows me. So he thought this would be a good thing to happen. So the first thing he did was he called a friend to get me a book agent. So, you know, how the heck do you get a book agent? So I get this phone call from this man. His name is David Black. And he says, "Hi, Paul, this is David Black, and I'd like to agent your book." And so coincidentally now he is agenting the book as it is being signed off to Hollywood to become a movie. So, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. So he says, "Well, you know, so I'm David Black and I'd like to agent your book." And I said, "Okay, well, great. Well, why should I give you the privilege of being the agent to my book?" And he said, "Well, that's a very good question. I am Mitch Albom's agent, Tuesdays with Maury, and I'm Dan Brown's agent, The Da Vinci Code." And I said, "You know what, I think you can be my agent." So we completely lucked out with that one. And he was able to find a publishing house that was willing to take a chance on this book.
Well, the name of the book is Run to the Roar. It's written by Paul Asiente and James Zug. It's out with Penguin Publishing, right? And you can download it on It's a book you can download as well. I'm going to take my next commercial break and our last commercial break. When I come back, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the stuff that's going on in tennis around the country and athletics around the country, and get you to get some of your insight on that. Coach Bayless, will you stay with us?
Yeah, I'll stay with you.
Okay, wonderful. We'll be right back.
This is Jason Haynes, the UR Tennis Network's Chief Executive Officer. Over the last 14 months, we have undergone a lot of changes here at the UR Tennis Network, and the Nike Tennis Camps have been one of our strongest supporters. They have had a very successful 2012 summer camp season and now are planning for 2013. We would like to thank them for allowing us to be an advertising avenue for their tennis camps. As we leave the summer, we want to encourage you to check out www.ussportcamps.com and start planning your next Nike camp experience. They have locations all over the U.S. for both adults and juniors. The Nike camps are offered in other sports such as golf, volleyball, soccer, swimming, softball, running, water polo, lacrosse, and field hockey. We want to encourage you to consider the Nike camp experience for your tennis needs. These camps are run by successful tennis coaches and offer a fun camp involvement where you learn new skills and make new friends. Be sure to check them out at www.ussportcamps.com or call them at 1-800-NIKE-CAMP and take your game to the next level.
Asiente, I don't know if you're familiar. We started a web page on Facebook called We Coach Tennis, and then it's sort of we got invited to do this We Coach Tennis radio show. And what I try to do is get guys on each week and go over some of the things that, you know, it may be some of the coaching stuff, but at the same time we look at some of the issues that coaches are faced with today here in with tennis mainly. and athletics in the United States. I'm hoping Coach Bayless will stay on. If he stays on, I'd love you guys to maybe comment on some of these things together. Now, part of your success, you have, if I'm not mistaken, 244 consecutive wins in squash.
Yeah, it was actually 252. And we lost to Yale. We play Yale this Wednesday night. That's 365 days ago. It's been a long time waiting for this rematch. But that was the streak.
Let me play for you. In the past, I've had on some different guys, and one of the issues, because a lot of your success, from what I can read and see, it's been from recruiting and coaching foreigners. And I'm going to play for you, and you've been a tennis coach as well. I'm going to play for you a comment. I had Wayne Bryan on the show, and let's listen to that comment, and then I'd like to get your reaction to that and see what your thoughts are. Here we go.
One is open and inclusive. Number two, I think the number two issue that's killing American tennis is the foreign player glut in American college tennis. How can some 10-year-old aspire, a 10-year-old boy to aspire to play for local college when he looks up and sees nobody from his home state or his hometown or from his home country playing on that school? That is wrong. The American taxpayers pay for those scholarships and the foreign kids take them. If all the foreign parents paid all those taxes, that's a different story. So issue number one, after open and inclusive and positive towards the membership, is the foreign player club in American college tennis. I've written extensively about it, been speaking out about it for 15 or 20 years.
Were you able to get any of that? Sometimes when I play,
it was very jumbled for me. But I think what I took away from that was that his feeling was that we need to protect the positions for U.S. grown players. Is that correct?
You got the gist of it. And he's for, and there are some people that are for, they're willing to look at maybe saying, okay, you can only have two foreigners on your teams. I'm wondering, you know, I've yet to find anybody that's been against that, but I haven't been able to interview some of the guys that actually do. And you're one of the first coaches that recruits foreigners. So go ahead.
And I think Bobby and I have come at this from slightly different angles too. So I welcome Bob's viewpoint on it. My feeling, I'm a very patriotic guy. I coached at West Point for 11 years. I served in the military. I am the USA national coach. I love this country, but I don't view college as a private country club. And I believe that it's our job to get the best and the brightest to come to our schools and play. Now, this idea was not my idea. 17 years ago, the president of the college called me into his office and he said, you guys play against Harvard and Penn and Yale, and you're fairly competitive with those schools. What do we need to do to be able to close that gap even more? And I said, well, to be honest with you, the best squash in the world is not being played in the United States. And he said, great, that's all I need to know. Go out and find the best and the brightest international kids. We're not going to give away more financial aid than we would normally. Now, remember, in Division III, there's no scholarship, so it's all financial aid. And he said, we will not compromise our academic standards. Now, go find these kids. And as I was walking out of the office, he said, now, Coach Asiente, don't screw it up. So, you know, right away the pressure was on. When I arrived at Trinity 20 years ago, the teams are ranked by grade point average 1 through 29, 29 sports for Trinity. The squash team, All-Americans, was ranked 29th in the grade point average of Trinity College. So we began trying to find good, bright young people. And 2 years ago, the top grade point average team at Trinity College was the men's squash team, and we were the national champions. So having these young people at our school improved the value and the culture on this campus. These kids are more disciplined. They're more hardworking. They're more engaged in student life. They become RAs. They work in the dorms. You know, they've made us a better school. Now, all of that said, and now I'm speaking as the USA national coach, I would rather play the national championships with 9 Americans, provided we could still win it. But at this moment in time, we can't.
Yeah, JP, let me just say one thing. When I first got into squash, I found that, and it's changed, certainly, and Paul's one of the people that have changed it, and the game of squash has grown. But some of the kids who were pretty darn good squash players and even made All-American hadn't played squash when they went to college. And so the issue is very different from tennis. What I think Paul has done and people like him have done, and right now his roster is not a whole lot different from the Ivy League schools, is to bring the game of squash to the United States and rather than looking at it the other way. In terms of the tennis, JP, you know where I stand. I've always felt like we need to protect our own roster spots and scholarships and so forth as much as is appropriate. But that's a very different deal in the world of squash. And also, you're keeping score. You want to win. And I think what Paul has done, his team on his campus, they are rock stars. They have elevated racket sports. There's a student body waiting for their team to come back after they've won the national championship in the middle of the night. And he's going to be too modest to say this. They've had a portion of the highway there in Connecticut named for the Trinity College squash teams. I've been to Hartford since then, and there's a lot there to tell you. They've really adopted the sport of squash. So he actually turned the sport into something special. And he actually had Dave Fish's son on his team.
That's true. I spoke to Dave last week.
Why'd your athletic director... Now, do you still coach tennis as well there?
Yes.
And
we lose a lot in tennis, by the way. So we get to see the beauty of learning through loss defeat as well.
Do you recruit foreigners for your tennis team?
Basically, we do have a couple of young men from foreign lands on our team. I wouldn't say that we're out there necessarily beating the bushes for them, but they sort of find us. Typically on the tennis side, they have to really be extraordinary academically to even, be given a look at. But, and on the other side of it, I understand exactly what, Coach Bryant and Bobby are saying. I think the goal should be to get our racket sports here in the United States stronger. I mean, I'm working very hard to get U.S. squash stronger. Our boys this past summer in Qatar finished 8th in the world. That was our best finish ever. Those boys are going to be very highly placed college players at Harvard and Yale and Princeton next year. So, I think we're catching up. I don't necessarily think we're catching up in tennis. That Bobby could answer that question better than I could. But, I think the goal is to get stronger on both sides.
Do any of your players cross over, play both?
When Bobby and I were at Army and Navy, all of our he actually had one or two boys that had actually played squash before. I think I only had one in my 11 years. So it was after fall tennis, I would take my plebes over to the squash courts and I would say, okay, now you guys have a choice. You can learn this wonderful new game of squash rackets, or you can box intramurals. It was a unanimous vote that they loved the game of squash.
Plus, Paul, they get to march 3 days a week.
Exactly, which is always fun. So,
and then sit on a training table for squash so you can get out of all the harassment.
Yeah, no, so it was a fairly easy sell. All of my tennis kids that come here learn the game of squash and love it because, like Bobby said, squash is almost religion at Trinity. But, you know, and, you know, we'll get a rainy day, and the tennis guys will say, let's go up and play squash rather than going to the indoor courts. But, you know, it's gotten to the point now where it's exclusive year-round, you know, tennis or squash.
In the U.S.
Yeah, those days are long gone.
They sure are.
The same players were on both teams. And when I first broke into tennis at the Naval Academy, the Ivy League schools were doing the same thing. A lot of the same players on both teams. And that they're simply too good in squash. And the change to the softer ball has made it more different and harder to pick up.
Sure. So is Coach Essiante, Coach Bayless, is Coach Essiante, is he sort of the Billy Chadwick of squash?
No. I think he's he's considered the guru. I mean, he's considered the John Wooden of squash.
Oh. Okay.
Well, last year, you know, and that's only.
Well, I'm not. I think Billy Chadwick's great. So I was looking at. I'm just trying to get a feel for in terms of the foreigners, for that 244 win streak. Is it based on these foreign athletes that came in and did this for you?
100%. Well, not 100%, but about 80%. I mean,
Paul, you're also playing against almost the same number of international players.
Oh yeah, there's no question. Harvard has no U.S. players in their lineup this year. I mean, this is last year there were 20 All-Americans, 17 of them were from foreign lands. I mean, that's where the game has gone, and they're good kids and. There's still a place. I don't think there's one good junior squash player in America today that will not play at a college next year. And, you know, for instance, what I do is there's 9 people that play in a varsity match. I carry 22 boys on the team. And I promise the number 22 boy that he will play in 50% of the varsity matches. And so when we play against a lesser school, we don't put the top guys out there. And they're out there playing. And then when we play Princeton, we'll clear the bench and play 22 against 22 and have, you know, 13 exhibition matches. So there's tons of squash opportunity, but the cream of the crop are world-class, you know, players. I mean, we saw this happen in tennis years ago when Baylor won the NCAAs. It was basically the German Davis Cup team. I mean,
this is
where we are.
Do you get any grief within the D3 community, the fact that you're doing this for and you're saying, oh, well, Coach Essiante's, you know, he's doing all this and he's giving these foreign guys. A lot of the other D3 schools don't go that route. Do you get grief?
There's actually more and more. St. Lawrence University, St. Lawrence, up there in upstate New York, yesterday beat Columbia 8-1. I mean, that's amazing. So the D3 schools are certainly in play. We've democratized the game in one sense, in that all of these schools are now fishing in the same, much larger international pond. It's interesting how it's gone. Yes, we've taken tremendous heat for this, internally and externally. And to be honest with you, I get deeply offended by this. I'll walk into a country club. One of my favorite people in the world is Mike Krzyzewski. When I was coaching at West Point, Mike was my neighbor, and my children used to beat up his children. And we still stay in touch. And he has actually contributed to this book, as has Billie Jean King. And when I walk into a country club, and the first question I'm asked is, how many Americans do you have on your team? I am so offended by that. I feel like it's almost like somebody walking up to Mike Krzyzewski and saying, how many whites do you have on your team? It's essentially, I don't think it's the right, I understand it, I get it. I do think, I agree with Bobby, there's maybe quotas, maybe protecting it in some way, but these are not private country clubs. And I don't think the exclusionary thing is the right thing, the way to go.
Yeah,
but
I would like, if I could be so bold,
I'd like to maybe suggest a change in direction on this conversation, because I too have two other topics I'd like to talk about that are challenges that Bobby and I think every coach in America today face.
Okay.
The first one is, I don't think our children are getting enough ownership. I know Bobby like a brother, and I know how Bobby grew up. And he was afforded an opportunity to play tennis as a young man. But I'll bet you his mother and father were not courtside watching too many of his junior matches. Bobby
never.
Never. Bobby owned his journey. And the most successful people in this world are people with ownership. This was something Billie Jean King used to talk to me about all the time. When she decided to turn pro, she told her dad she wanted to turn pro, and he said, fine, you took out a second job. But her parents didn't come to any more of her matches than they had come to before that point. And in the name of love, we're seeing junior parents depriving their children the critical ownership that they need to have over their journey. And as a result, these kids are coming to us now essentially crippled, because they haven't learned how to make decisions for themselves, because mommy and daddy have taken care of it for them. I get people call me all the time, you know, should we play this tournament? Should we play that tournament? What's the best way we can get the best ranking? You know, basically monitoring and manipulating the system to the detriment of the development of these children. And I think that's a terrible disease. And you're seeing it in every other sport in America, you know, the hockey moms and the soccer dads. We and Bobby's in my generation were given the keys to the kingdom and told, go out and do it. And that's not happening anymore.
Is there anything we can do about that, though?
Well,
JP, I used to tell people when I was at the Wellesley Country Club when Paul was up in Rye at the Apawamis Country Club, and I had a couple of really serious players that wanted to go play big-time college tennis and so forth. And I told them, parents, that, okay, it's important that you make your son or daughter earn their lessons because they need to cut the grass, wash the dishes, do whatever to earn the lessons. And they looked at me like I was crazy. Well, I can afford it. This isn't a hardship. And I said, no, you don't understand how much pressure they're going to feel. They're going to know that you spent all this money on them. And first of all, you don't even know if they love it. And if they don't want to earn it, then they probably shouldn't be. You should find something else for them to do. And some of them thought I was didn't know how to deal with today's kids, and a few of them actually listened to me and bought in, and I think the kids were better off for it. But I used to hitchhike to the public courts to play tennis, and I didn't have a ride, and sometimes I had to, you know, when I was 18, 19, 20 years old, I thought I was too cool to ride a bike. So I'd either run and it was a 4 or 5 miles. So it was a ways.
Well, let me ask you guys this. You get the, I don't know if you, and how's the echo? Is that better? Is it any better?
It's good.
That is good now, yeah.
Okay, now let me, because Courier just sort of addressed this. Courier was asked, you know, he's the Davis Cup captain, and he said, history shows that the very best of our players, the parents were real involved. Now, but if I talk to Coach Asciante, Coach Bayless, if I talk to Coach Creasy, they're telling you, look, the parents have got to they've got to back off and take a back seat. So what's the answer? How do we, you know, because Courier's saying history says that, you know, the parents are involved.
No, they are and they aren't. They're not helicopters. They facilitate
it. You hold on to the person you love with an open hand. You provide your children opportunity. But it's theirs to walk through the door and carry the water. I had a conversation with a man the other day whose son applied early decision to Trinity. And throughout the entire process, he basically was trying to push this through and was saying, like, you know, I'll write a check tomorrow. How much, you know, what can I do to, you know, make sure that, you know, Biff gets in and so forth and so on. Well, this boy got admitted. And the night that the acceptance letter went home, I called the father and I said, I want to tell you something. Before you send your check, your deposit in, I want you to think about what I'm about to say to you. This is my classroom. You are not welcome in my classroom. You are now turning him over to me. And you, I hope to see you at the matches. You can make chocolate chip cookies if you want. I will not take your phone calls. You will not come into my classroom. And if you can deal with that, then send your deposit. And if you can't, your son should go to a different school. We have this syndrome that's going on now, and Bobby called it the helicopter parent. I actually call it the Velcro parent because the helicopter flies away. The Velcro doesn't. I will get a call from my athletic director. He will call me into his office, and he will show me an email that was sent to the president of the school that was passed on to the athletic director discussing something I did with my program. And when we sit and we look at this email, this long, voluminous email discussing the esoteric values of sport and society, if you read between the lines, all they're talking about is that Johnny is not getting enough playing time.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to control the job we're doing. And I can tell you, knowing Bobby as I do, Bobby likes to win. Bobby hates to lose. Bobby's a teacher. He'll make whatever decision needs to be made to help this person grow, to become not only a better tennis player, but a better member of society on the other side. That cannot happen with parents meddling. They're not interested in that. The end game in most of junior tennis and most of junior squash is to provide the youngster the opportunity to get into a college that they might not have been able to get into otherwise, or a higher scholarship. That's not what the end game should be. The end game should be that through this sport, they will learn lessons that will make them better members of our society on the other side of it. And that's getting lost in the mix. So now Currier is coaching the Davis Cup team. So he's dealing with the 1%. And to get to that level requires a phenomenal investment of money. And that's not happening without parents' involvement. But that's 1% or less than 1%. That's not the kids that Bobby and I are dealing with every day, or Chris. That's not how, or Dave Fish, it's not happening. We're not helping our kids grow up in this society. And I'm seeing more cheating in the classroom than I've ever seen before because mommy and daddy are not there to take the test for them. And, I mean, look at it now, Bobby. When you were at the Naval Academy, did any of your kids have ADHD? Were any of your kids on Ritalin because they had learning, you know, challenges? Of course not.
No.
Now a kid does poorly on the SAT. Immediately there's a doctor's letter written saying that Johnny has a learning situation, so he should be able to take untimed SATs. Why? So he can get into the best college humanly possible. We're crippling our kids. We're not giving them the value of what they should be learning through this sport.
What got us here? What got us to this situation?
I think society has become that way, and it's not, certainly not just a tennis and squash problem.
How does a tennis coach? So what do you do at your level, Coach Asciani? You give this lecture to this dad before his kid comes to the school, and you hope it works out, and that's the way you change things?
Well, no. Then you've got to deal with the crippled child every day. And you've got to teach him to learn, first of all, that the team is more important than he is because he's been raised to believe he's the center of the universe. So imagine in squash, I have a boy from Pakistan playing on the same court with a boy from India. Their parents are not even talking to each other. So I've got all kinds of cultural challenges in that regard. But I emphasize team only. We don't talk about individual accomplishments. And I find that if I just harp on this and harp on this, and they begin to understand that they're playing for the benefit of the greater good, they start to take a little bit of ownership in sort of a backwards way, because they're no longer playing for themselves. And so,
and Paul, that's how you change the world. That's how you change the world, because maybe the people in India won't hate the people in Pakistan, because they found out they have some friends.
Yep.
What is your next? You mentioned you had another topic that you wanted to try and bring forward, Coach Essiani.
Well, the thing was the ownership issue, and then of course the helicopter or the Velcro parent. I think the two things that will push the Bobby Baylesses out of the business, and any great coaches, are one, the parents. Parents are making this really difficult, and it doesn't need to be. And the second thing is recruiting. Star Wars recruiting is just exhausting. And in the old days, you could call a young man and he would say, Trinity's my top choice, or coach, to be honest with you, I'm going to apply early decision to Yale. If that doesn't work out, Trinity's my second choice. And that was perfectly fine, but honesty was clear. I still was going to, support this boy on the other side of this, but at least we both knew where we were coming from. Now kids are not as honest and forthcoming. And so you're just constantly hit by these curveballs, because the recruiting game has become just so exhausting and so unpredictable. Bobby is selling Notre Dame. I mean, and he's selling himself, and he's selling what values his boys will learn through him. I'm selling an entirely different product. And that's basically what we're out trying to promote. But we're not, there's so much going on behind the scenes that it makes you crazy. You just, it's exhausting. I probably spend 85% of my day dealing with recruiting.
And a good portion of it probably involves the parents.
A lot of it involves the parents. We probably the thing, and I've spoken to coaches who are out of the game for a while, and I ask them, what do you miss? And you know what they all tell me? I miss practice. I'll bet you if you ask Dallas before he retires, what will he miss most? We love to teach.
Right.
We like to get in there and educate. And we, in what's happening in society now, probably 5% of what we do is actually coaching. The rest of it is all of the other stuff that we have to deal with in the course of a day.
Right. Let me try. I'd like to hold you over just for a few minutes. If you can stay with me a few extra minutes, I'd like to ask you a few other questions about some of the things that I have each week, if that's okay. Can I ask you that?
Well, sure, anything.
Tell me about now what I do, and I'm very curious about this because you're going to come at it from a totally different angle, I'm sure. The USTA spent a lot of money, and they've come up with what they've called the 10 and under mandate, or 10 and under tennis. Have you watched this? Have you seen this? And what are your thoughts on this?
Oh, we part of the stipulation of building the brand new tennis center this year was we went out and raised monies, and some of it was from the USTA, and some of it was actually from the city of Hartford. And one of the things we said we would do is we would give back to the community. And so we have that happening at our courts, and I love it. To see these little munchkins out there actually being able to have rallies, and I think it's great. It's teaching them the game much, much more quickly.
What are your thoughts on the mandated portion of it? In other words, here in the southern section, for example, my son, he's 6 now, and he got all of his mom's genes, and so he does quite well. He's able to rally from a 78-foot court. He's six
right.
years old, 100 times with another pro yell a ball from 78 foot. Now, he can't do that with another six-year-old, but with a pro, he could do that. Here in the South, he will not be allowed to play with a yellow ball until he turns 13 years of age.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. Well, look, I don't, it's a little bit like the classroom, and one of the problems we have in the classroom is we tend to teach down to the lesser, you know, we bring the class down to the lowest common denominator, and we don't really have systems in place to challenge or stimulate the prodigal or the really truly talented. Sounds like your son is one of those people, thank God.
Until he finds squash. If he finds squash.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think the mandate is probably a bad thing. I think the idea of providing that opportunity certainly must have gotten many, many, many more kids playing tennis early than otherwise. But I think if your child has moved past that point, they should be allowed then to go to the level that they're able to rise to.
Does squash do anything, even internationally? Do they do anything equivalent to what they've done in
Germany? No, nothing like that. Nothing.
They
like
haven't
that
shrunk
all.
The court or
no.
Sporting the rackets
no.
or nothing
no.
like that?
No.
So how long have you been, overall, you've been coaching, you started out, now I was talking with Coach Bayless earlier. You started out, you had a gymnastics background, and you ended up coming and becoming quite accomplished in both tennis and squash. You've been in this now for how many years?
I've been doing this for 40 years. I was a gymnast in college and actually was training to try to compete internationally. And I had a pretty bad injury, and so I figured I got to take up something that, you know, I can, has a more social component to it. So I started playing tennis, but I started playing tennis very late. And there are some real benefits to learning something when you're old enough to actually learn. You know, I think you can train a seal to hit a ball, but you can't train a seal to play the game. So I, in some ways, I was very lucky to start so late because, for one, as you can imagine, tennis and squash are infinitely easier than gymnastics. I mean, the body awareness and what you need for that sport is insane. It doesn't require a lot of hand-eye coordination, and fortunately I was fairly, not very, but fairly talented with hand-eye coordination. And so I had a great body awareness in space because of gymnastics, so I was able to imitate the strokes and learn fairly quickly, and so it was an easy thing to do. And you can get fairly good at these games fairly quickly, just time on court. And so I was very fortunate.
Coach, did you have a comment? I thought I heard you.
No, I agree. I agree with everything Paul said. And as far as the mandate goes,
in your 40 years of coaching, what do you see? And then I'm going to ask you with regard to tennis. You sort of hinted at it a little bit before when I first called you this afternoon, Coach Asciante, but what do you see as being the biggest game changer in the history of tennis?
Well, I got to tell you, I don't understand the game anymore. As a matter of fact, we're hosting the National Squash Singles Championships on March 5th. And on March 6th, I'm boarding a plane and flying to South Bend, Indiana to spend 3 days with Bobby Bayless because I don't get where the game has gone. I still am of the mind that you get out there and you rally and you create and you move in and you take short balls and you get in and you create a volley opportunity. And if it's a good volley, maybe you get an overhead. And that game doesn't exist anymore. It does a little bit at the Division III level, obviously. But, you know, I'm watching Djokovic play against Wawrinka today. And Djokovic is the number one player in the world. And Wawrinka will hit a ball from 85 feet away that Djokovic can't even take a step for. I mean, the amount of power and the amount of strength that these men and women possess has changed the game so much, but it still goes against my logical thinking that you can get away with something from 78 feet and then put another 60 behind it. You can get away with something from there. I still believe you got to move in and create wider angles. And, you know, I'm still stuck in the old mindset a little bit, and I can get away with it in Division III tennis. But what's going on with the improved equipment and with the incredible strength that these guys are showing, the game has passed my comprehension. I almost have to watch women play most of the time because it's still a little bit comprehensible. So the men's game has just gone to another place. It's just beyond belief.
Let me ask both of y'all, Coach Bayless, and I'm just curious, I'm going to follow up with that one real quick. Coach Asciante, the same jump didn't happen in squash?
Well, the game changed in the United States when we moved to the international ball. So what Bobby was alluding to before is in the United States, we actually used to play a different sport. We built a court that was smaller. We played with a livelier ball. We've now adopted. So imagine grass court tennis, but on a smaller court. That's essentially what we were playing here in squash. Then imagine going over and playing the French Open with Pirelli balls. That's what everybody else around the world was playing. So we've adopted that game in the United States now. So it's actually a different sport. What we are seeing is that the boys are becoming so fit that we actually had to change the configuration of the court to make it more spectator interesting. So there is actually in a squash court, and in Atlanta, racquetball is still fairly big. In racquetball, there's no front wall boundary. There's no low boundary. You can hit a ball that will hit the juncture of the floor and the front wall. In squash, there's like a little net, if you will. And what we're doing in squash now is because the boys are so much more fit, we're actually lowering the height of the net. So the ability to end the rally is greater. And so it's more spectator-friendly because these guys can go out there. In the World Championships last year, the first rally of the match lasted 184 hits, and it ended in a let, which basically was a do-over. 184 hits in the first rally. I mean, that's just eviscerating. So we are changing the configuration of the court a little bit to make it easier to put the ball away because these guys are just so fit.
And the rackets haven't done the same, you know.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the rackets are bigger and more powerful, they're lighter. Just like in tennis, we've had that switch into squash.
Hmm. Coach Bayless?
Yeah.
Are you still there? Did you hear what he was saying with regard to the change in terms of...
Sure, yeah, no. And Paul and I learned to play squash. We played with a slightly softer golf ball in the little box.
Exactly.
And we could hit each other and do bodily harm.
Well, you know, was one of Bayless's specialties, by the way.
We just had Coach Bayless, and it's interesting. You know, last year I kind of commented to you. And Coach Asciante, you probably would have been feeling the same way I did. I watched the NCAAs this past year down in Athens, and I watched the number 3 doubles team, men's team. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm almost positive that they went 2 back on the serve at one point.
Yeah, no, we're seeing that all the time.
Yeah.
And I had Ned Caswell here for a high school coach's seminar this past weekend, Coach Bayless, and Ned Caswell is convinced, and you know, he's taken on Paul Scarpa's sort of innovative, you know, brand. You know, he learned from Coach Scarpa. He doesn't believe that, you know, coming in is the it's never going to happen again.
The difference is today the strings have given the ball a dimension that it didn't used to have. And you remember the Michael Fishback spaghetti racket back 25
sure.
or 30 or whatever years ago? They outlawed that. Well, the strings hold the ball now, and they have the snapback that they didn't used to have. And it's given – you can't tell if something's a passing shot or a lob. And so it's much tougher when you come in. And you can hit the ball harder with them. So it's, you know, but I believe everything's in cycles, and I do think the net play will get back there, and I think the slice will be an answer to some of the – people are going to learn to slice a little better because the grips are pretty extreme. It'll be tough to get under the ball. Then you can get, you know, an approachable ball and so forth. So, I mean, we still do it. We still teach all-court tennis, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but we still do that. And I have made some concessions to realize that the serve and stay back doubles, to some extent, is gonna be a part of doubles, and you have to learn how to play against it. I still don't try to I don't want our guys to do that, and because they won't develop their games fully. But there are going to be certain situations where if somebody has a really big forehand, that I'll allow it on a second serve if they're getting beat in volley and exchanges.
Well, Coach, Coaches Bayless and Asiani, I appreciate you guys coming on today. I'm probably going to have to wrap it up here tonight. I've got a commitment that I have to get to. I would love to, Coach Asiani, I would love to have you back. I think I mentioned to you that I had a little bit of trouble getting ready for tonight's show. We've got some situations going on here. But I'd love to have you back. I'm going to read the book. And I'd like to have you, you know, come back and talk with us some more.
Anytime. And if you need
JP,
to
it's
find
the best book I've ever read on sports. It's the best sports book I've ever read.
Well, I've gotten a few passages. I'm already enthralled by it. So I've got it on my iPhone. I'm going to go ahead and listen to it. And anybody out there listening, you ought to take a look at this book. I think it's going to be a good one. And I'm looking forward to the movie. And I'm looking forward. You know, I'm thinking from your picture here, Tom Hanks would be the right guy. I could see that.
Well, you know, and of course, it was an honor to be on the call with Bobby, particularly since he beat me on the last point. But in terms of, you know, having somebody else on a call with me, there's about 800 people out there that you could also have because they've also won the last point against me. So you've got a long list of people that could join us.
Now, I would love to get you back on and explore a little bit more about the ownership. I could probably talk for 30 minutes on that. I would love to get you back on about that and any of the other things would be very interested in. And Coach Bayless, you too. You know, I'd like to get you back on it. If, you know, when you're available. I know that you're getting ready to go into the meat of your season. Probably both of you are going to be quite busy. But if you know, I've switched it to Sunday nights and it seems to work okay on Sunday nights. So
normally Bobby and I are at church at this time, but it's a little chilly up here. So anytime works for me.
All right, guys, thanks for coming on, and I'll talk to you in the future.
Thanks, JP.
Thanks, Bobby.
Opinions stated by various contributors to UR10's radio and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR10's network. Visitors are urged to use their own discernment to draw their own conclusions. All information, products, services, and use of this website is for personal use only. UR10's radio does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of the information contained within the website. Any services or products provided by UR10's radio and its hosts or contributors should be used solely for entertainment and enjoyment. We emphasize the importance of keeping an open mind and not construing the data, products, and/or services as factual.